Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Jonathan Farrell and Lisa Abramowitz. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg Terminal. Right now is a special moment, not only for Bloomberg Surveillance for all of New York City, but indeed it is a national story. Eric Adams is the Democratic nominee for New York City mayor. This is two other candidates did not go for a recount and conceded in the last 12, even 18 hours. Joining me now for a conversation with the Democratic nominee is, of course, Romaine Bostic and for Lisa Abramowitz. And we're absolutely thrilled to have Shelley Banjo with us. She has driven our coverage here at Bloomberg. This started out as, another race. And then it became something different. Eric Adams, thank you so much for joining us this morning. I'm going to let Shelley talk about ear piercings and all that that we've seen in the last 24 hours. I want to talk about your first meeting as mayor with the New York Police Department. How do you envision that will go?
Well, first, it started already, and it's not with the department. It's with the union heads. I had a conversation with Pat Lynch, a conversation with Ed Mullins, a conversation with the president of the DEA. It's about going behind closed doors and say, let's turn a new page. I said this over and over again, the prerequisite to prosperity in the city is public safety and reform. And they are eager to sit down with me and say, how do we move policing into the 21st century, deeper into the 21st century? Will we reestablish the relationships between police and community? Because our cities will be controlled by the good guys or the bad guys. And right now, all across America, the bad guys are winning. And I'm going to stop that immediately.
Are you going to do that with Dermot McShea at the helm?
No, I'm not. I've made it clear that my police commissioner is going to be a woman. We're going to finally bring the entire city, the largest police department in the country, into the 21st century of women leadership in law enforcement. Yeah. And I'm look at three of the candidates that I've been communicated with.
And I'm sure you know, obviously, being a veteran of that force, that's not going to come easy, Eric. We've seen the fraught relationship between the police, the rank and file, the unions, and, of course, the mayors of the past here. You've also had a relatively complicated relationship, despite being a veteran of that department here. How do you bridge that, Eric? How are you going to do that in a way where the police, which are a mighty force in this city, Eric, some would say even mightier than the mayor himself?
Well, first of all, it is easy. And those who state it's not going to be easy, they don't know me. I had difficult challenges in my life, being beat, arrested by police officers, assaulted, went into the police department, fought for reform, moved up through the ranks of captain, became a state senator, now bar president, reversed diabetes by changing my diet. And so difficult challenges is not something that I run away from, I run towards. What we must do is stop talking at each other around reform and safety and start talking with each other. And you're going to see in the first year a complete change in the atmosphere of public safety and how our police officers respond. We're going to rid the bad cops. We're going to back our good cops. And we're going to reestablish the relationships in our communities. And it's going to be done in year one. I promise you that.
The three women that you're currently in conversation with, are they within the New York Police Department or are you looking outside?
What I don't want to do is say, is it bigger than the bread box or smaller than the house? Because that limits the number of potential candidates, and many of them are working right now. And I don't want to in any way jeopardize what they're doing. I will reveal those numbers immediately after I win the general election in November. I reveal the individual I decided on.
Fair enough. And another big force to be reckoned with is obviously Governor Andrew Cuomo in Albany. You have had a checkered past, so to speak, with him. But, you know, you guys have run in the same political circles for almost your entire adult lives. Did he call you to congratulate you? And what's the first thing you're going to try to work with him in Albany on?
And we don't have a checkered past. Clearly, we are both strong in what we believe. We know how to sit down and communicate. We've operated together when I was in Albany, and I'm looking forward to having him as a partner as we deal with, number one, public safety. I cannot really emphasize this enough. We're not going to deal with major parts of our economy, tourism, if we have shootings in Times Square. No one's going to get on the subway system if we continue the violence there. And so we're going to first deal with making our city safe, and then we're going to use the dollars that are coming from the federal government to go after the feeders of crime and the feeders that prevent people from finally leaving institutional poverty year after year. And I believe that having a partner in Albany, we could accomplish this task together.
Eric Adams, they're going to study your candidacy, the path of this mayoral race for you in Brooklyn, in Bronx. They're also going to study it in Boston and also in Boise, Idaho. You're going to have a national ramification for all Democrats. What does your victory say about the certitude of the left in the Democratic Party?
Well, you know, if you are a DSA candidate or if you are a Republican candidate, you don't want to be pushed on the train or slashed.
Right.
So I think that what you're going to see, I'm the face of the Democratic Party. I keep saying this over and over again. I won four boroughs in the city of New York. The only borough I did not win is Manhattan. My message resonated with everyday working people. And it didn't matter with your ethnicity, your gender. Didn't matter your worship. And I think that you're going to see this message resonate across this entire country. And it's an opportunity for us to understand that we don't have to talk at each other. We are in this together. And I'm going to bring the city closer together so that we can overcome not only the pandemic, but also the pandemic of unemployment, of violence, and inequality.
Very quickly, Eric, we are on television and we are on radio, and a number of radio listeners have emailed in and said, what's the piercing look like? Where's the piercing this morning, Mayor Adams?
Wow, look at this.
It's a gold earring. My son and I, we attended a meeting with a group of young people during the campaign, and they said that we will vote for you if you commit and promise to get your ears pierced if you become a win the primary. And a promise made is a promise kept. And I did it yesterday.
I can assure you the 108th mayor of New York did not go through this torture. Eric Adams, thank you so much. We look forward to speaking to you again. Let's be clear, the Democratic nominee for New York City mayor. It is not a calm time for our Secretary of Transportation. Mr. Buttigieg, of course, we all know from South Bend, Indiana, sterling academics, including something that we all did as a kid. Could we write an essay off John F. Kennedy's Profiles in Courage? And the Secretary delivered the goods as a young kid. We want to talk about transportation. We want to talk about international travel. But yes, right now in infrastructure. Mr. Secretary, thank you so much for joining Bloomberg this morning. I lived the last infrastructure disaster, which is you drove out Indiana West and there was a point where I-80 died and you had a two-lane highway west. We're going back to that on the condition of our infrastructure, and we're doing it because we cannot figure out how to do a gas tax. Can't you do a gas tax that will pay for the roads, rebuild America, and also be politically acceptable for Democrats?
Well, it turns out you don't have to. And what's so great about the bipartisan infrastructure framework that the president led, that a set of Democratic senators and Republican senators have come together on, is that it will deliver the biggest investment in American infrastructure in more than a generation. The biggest investment in our roads and bridges since Eisenhower, the biggest investment in passenger rail since Amtrak, the biggest investment in public transit ever, without having to ask Americans to pay any more in taxes, any American who makes less than $400,000 a year. This was a promise that the president made when he was running for president. He plans to keep that promise, and so he was very firm on that. But what's clear is that it is absolutely possible to make these kinds of investments by looking to other funding sources that don't ask that of ordinary Americans. And we're thrilled that this critical mass of Republican and Democratic senators agree. We think it's one of the reasons why so many Americans agree that this is the right thing to do. Now we need Congress to move it forward, get it to the president's desk so that we can get those dollars working, whether it's on our highways and bridges, our airports and ports, or on some of the things that are newer to the infrastructure picture, like our digital infrastructure and getting everybody online.
You mentioned Dwight David Eisenhower. I remember going off the infrastructure road of Kansas onto the two-lane highway to his museum. All wonderful. Dwight Eisenhower had to fight his Republicans to get the vision of the interstate highway system done. How can you bring over Republicans to get a majority vote to rebuild America?
You know, I found that people don't agree on much here in Washington across party lines, but they agree on the need, as you've been describing, and as every American sees. You know, when I'm talking to House or Senate members, Republican or Democrat, what I notice that they all have in common is they're all from somewhere. They're all home right now, actually, this week during this July 4th recess. They're all home talking to constituents saying, when are we going to get this bridge fixed? Why is our airport looking the way it's looking? How are we this far behind on transit or whatever it is in their district? And so, yes, I do believe that we have finally reached this point of, if not consensus, then overlap. And I think that's why you had this remarkable sight of the president walking out of the West Wing a few days ago, flanked by Democratic and Republican senators saying, we have a deal. Now, we have a deal is not the same thing as we have a bill. That's what's happening right now, turning it into legislative text, moving it through these processes, committees that have jurisdiction over this. There's a lot of machinery, especially this month of July, that is going through its motions here in Washington. But it's resulting, I believe, in the opportunity for something that that we have needed for really the better part of my lifetime, as we've watched these investments degrade, as we've coasted off of decisions that were made generations ago. You know, last time I was in New York was to look at the Hudson River tunnels, the finest infrastructure technology of 1910, and we're still depending on
it for the Northeast corridor. Look at that shade, John. Look at the shade the secretary gives to New York City.
Mr. Secretary, there are some things that are easy to get done and haven't been done. Infrastructure is one of them, I guess. Another is international travel restrictions. We're trying to work out when we get an update from your administration. When is that going to happen?
So it, unfortunately, it can't be based on an arbitrary date. It has to be based on conditions. But I can tell you, as the Transportation Secretary, of course, I am as impatient as anybody to see us move as quickly as we responsibly can toward more forms of reopening. Right now, what's going on is a set of working group processes. So we've convened working groups with our international partners. Yep. There's one for the UK, one for the EU, one for Canada, one for Mexico, to determine the right pathway forward. A lot of this is based on what's going on with progress on the vaccines. Obviously, we see good news and bad news out there in terms of the variants. One moment, you're reading about a variant happening across the world. The next, you know, it's becoming the dominant strain here in the U.S.
And it is, sir. And if you allow me to jump in, because we push for time, the Delta variant has become the dominant strain here in the United States of America, according to the CDC, and very quickly so, too. From my position personally, forgive me for saying this, but you didn't have to watch your father's funeral down the screen of an iPhone on Tuesday. I did, because of your policies. Now, I expected you to bring up the science, and I expected a quote that came from you to be used, because you used it a month ago, 2 months ago. Here are the policies for our audience so they understand them. Currently, if you're a citizen of the United States of America, or if you have a green card, you can travel to the UK and you can fly directly back. If you have an H-1B visa or an L-1, you can fly to the UK, but to come back to America, you need to go to Mexico City and spend 2 weeks there in a third country to get back to New York. Sir, forgive me, but I've spoken to scientists about this, and there is no scientific rationale for that policy. So for me and thousands of others who haven't got to be with their loved ones through a critical time because of your policies, sir, there will be thousands more if you carry on repeating the same line and don't just look at this and change it. Why are you not changing the policy when we have scientists day after day say there's no scientific rationale for maintaining it?
Well, first of all, let me say I'm sorry to hear about your father. And let me also say that I am among those who are impatient to see loved ones who live across the Atlantic. Let me also say that the U.S. is going to be conservative in dealing
Secretary
with
Buttigieg,
the phenomenon
for jumping
that has
in.
Led to
forgive
the deaths of 600,000 Americans.
You keep going back to this, sir.
And so
there is no scientific rationale to draw a distinction between someone who has a green card, an H-1B visa, or an L-1. You know that. I know that. Regardless of anything you say for the next couple of minutes, it's not going to justify it. What I need to understand from you as a policymaker is why thousands of people who live in this country legally and pay taxes cannot go home to see loved ones and return directly, and why you still repeat the same line again and again and again. It doesn't make it true. You do not have a scientific rationale for this. You cannot back it up with science, sir. Why are you not going away with policymakers and doing something?
So our tools are imperfect, right? We are dealing with a country-based framework for assessing risk, when in a perfect world, we would know all the information we needed to have for a traveler-based framework. We can move in that direction somewhat. That's more refined and ultimately more accurate from a risk assessment perspective. But we don't have the toolkit to do that in a way that would be as smooth as we would want. So yeah. We're going to continue to have a strategy led by public health authorities, guided by Homeland Security, CDC, my department at the table, to reopen travel as quickly as we responsibly can.
Secretary Buttigieg, I'm not talking about a broad-based reopening, though. Forgive me for jumping in. No, just allow me to get this thought in, because it's important to what you're about to say. I need you to understand that I'm talking about working people in this country who are working here legally. With the stroke of a pen, you could enable thousands of people in this country who work illegally and pay taxes to return home to loved ones. And you can do that by making an equal treatment for people with an H-1B, an L-1, a green card, and a resident of this country. You know that's not difficult. That's not a large change. That's allowing people who work in this country to get back and see loved ones like they want to. And sir, I'm not gonna lay on this on any thicker than I already have. You didn't have to watch your mum stand by your father's casket in a funeral 2 days ago, because you won't do what I'm describing. It's easy. And us together in this conversation, I hope you go away and make the changes so that thousands of other people don't have to go through what I've gone through in the last month. Can we make that happen, sir?
So these are exactly the kinds of things that we're reviewing on a daily basis. I'm the transportation secretary. My entire job is to do everything I can to safely get people to where they need to be and where they want to be, whether it's to be with loved ones, whether it's to do business. It's literally what I'm here in Washington to do. Nothing about this, respectfully, nothing about this is easy. We're dealing with a phenomenon that has led to the deaths of 600,000 Americans. We're dealing with imperfect information, complex policies, legacy policies. Nothing about this is easy. But what I will tell you is we are doing everything we can, as quickly as we responsibly can, to get back up and running.
Mr. Secretary, would you support a passport equivalent? I have a passport. I happened to study microbiology a few years ago. Why can't I get a passport, a federal passport, that says I've been vaccinated?
Well, there are a lot of privacy and technology issues, but I do think it's worth noting, you know, you may have had this experience too. I had it when I was younger, traveling internationally, of carrying a yellow CDC passport that reflected the vaccinations that I needed to demonstrate that I had to travel to parts of Southeast Asia and Africa. We have forms of this that are frankly very low tech and out mm-hmm. of date. How to balance that with the privacy issues is a challenge, and we've decided right. that it's not the federal government's job to establish these kinds of requirements, but it is important to make sure that there are ways for people who want to demonstrate that they are vaccinated to prove it. And we've seen a lot of third party and private sector ways to do this. And I think that's going to continue to develop and needs to have continued support at the policy level, too.
What's your biggest headache right now in getting this infrastructure plan through? I know you're managing a message every day, and certainly we've seen that with President Biden. This is a big emotional piece of American legislation. How do you get it through with a fractious Senate?
I think the biggest thing is not to let the politics get in the way. Look, people are impatient for this to happen, but it's been infrastructure week for a good decade or so, and we need to demonstrate that it's actually going to get done this time. The policy framework is clear. The pathway forward is clear. We need these roads and bridges. We need better airports. There are listings of airports where not one of the top 25 is actually in the United States. That's unacceptable to the president. I think it's unacceptable to most Americans. We want to get this done. The biggest thing we have to do is actually move it through Congress and make sure that as this turns into the very specific mechanical legislative text, that we're tearing down any obstacles to getting it to the president's desk. But I feel an enormous amount of momentum for this on both sides of the aisle. And our job is to make sure that momentum gets us all the way across the finish line.
Mr. Secretary, I appreciate your time this morning. And thank you very much for hearing us ask our questions and for responding them too. Peter Buttigieg there, Pete Buttigieg, the U.S. Secretary of Transportation.
Right now, we've been just thrilled with what our booking team has done to bring in Equity Voices. Lizanne Saunders with us. Ed Yardeni yesterday, Abby Joseph Cohen, and now we continue with Jonathan Golub of Credit Suisse. His calls early in the year were distinct, and they were different. We get an update this morning. John Golub, can you give me S&P 5000 this morning? I got to make some news.
I don't know if I can give you S&P 5000, but the things that have made me optimistic about the market are still in place. And more than anything else, it's earnings. We're going to start to hear,
yes.
I think it's next Tuesday, from J.P. Morgan and the big banks. The consensus view is that we'll have 61% upside in earnings versus a year ago. Our read is that that number is going to be 75%, and if we're wrong, we're too low.
Okay, so this is really important, folks. We're going to stop the show right now because this is critical. We're going to get to that earnings call. We all know consensus is different now than it's ever been. John Golub, can you make a shift to secular growth based off those earnings, or do you got to hide in a hole because the world's going to come to an end 18 months later?
No, I mean, I don't think that this story is changed as much as the headlines are. I think there's two battles. The fundamentals are unbelievably strong. This is going to be the strongest GDP quarter we've seen. The economic data is generally very good and continues to improve. Value is cheaper than growth. Cyclical, old economy, boring companies are delivering stronger growth. These are companies like mining companies, things like that. Now, if you look at what happens, however, when interest rates fall, the market favors growth stocks in a falling interest rate environment. This is all of the market is great. The question is just, as you guys have mentioned, where's the leadership? What wins within the market? Because the market still wants to go up and to the right.
John, why can't I just buy the market, buy the S&P? Why do I have to get into the detail? Why is it all about active management this year when quite clearly you're doing okay just holding the S&P 500?
I don't think that's a terrible call. If you are a hedge fund that's watching this show, you don't have that option. You have to try to figure out how you're going to outsmart the market. And for them, I think the story is between now and the end of the year, value wins, cyclicals win, and that there will be a time for growth, but it's not right now. If you're a long-term investor, whether you buy the broad market or whether you buy these tech themes that Romain highlighted, we're selling off. Long term, it's a growth story. So if you're an individual, you could ride the wave that way. If you're a hedge fund, you got to play this more tactically.
Let's put a bow on it then. Let's make the big point. What's more important here, the earnings or where the 10-year yield is? Because, John, I've asked that question repeatedly in the last 24 hours, and they'll say the latter, not the former. I can sense that you think it's very much about the former. It's about where the earnings go.
Listen, if you're looking at the overall market, the whole thing is an earnings story. As a matter of fact, for all those that are talking about how expensive the market is because stock prices are up, there's been no increase in valuations and PE multiples in a year. The stock market is moving only with the earnings story. If you're looking at this in terms of within the market, growth versus value, tech versus financials, then it's about interest rate, but the market, it's an earnings story, full stop.
Put into perspective here, Jonathan, how resilient the earnings picture has been. I mean, there's been obviously a lot of disruptions. There's been a lot of talk about supply chains. There's been a lot of talk about wage growth. The idea here that all these sort of various factors would somehow upend the earnings picture for some of these companies and overall, at least on an aggregate basis, it's held up pretty well.
Yeah, you know, Romain, you make a good point here. First of all, the smartest question I recently got was not what is this year's earnings versus last year, because we know last year was a beaten up number. What does it look like compared to 2 years ago? Are we above prior peaks? The expectations consensus is that we'll be about 9% above where we were 2 years ago. Our estimate is that we'll be 19% above by the time all the reports are in for this quarter. So yeah. That's really amazing. We still have all this disruption. We can't get the things that we want delivered at all. The unemployment rate is high, and yet we're talking by the end of this quarter, we'll probably have 20% stronger earnings growth than we did before the pandemic started.
I mean, Romain Gallup talks about the smart question he got 4 years ago there. No, the best question Gallup got, Romain, was John Farrell's question a moment ago. Are we supposed to be worried about earnings or the 10-year yield? That's the money question.
Yeah, I mean, that is the money question. And look, I mean, obviously, Jonathan, you know, people are going to obsess over this. They're going to obsess over 125 or whatever we are now. They're going to obsess over whether we're headed towards 1% or whether we're headed back up towards 2% here. I mean, provide some sort of soothing advice here. What do you tell people who are maybe staying up late at night, staring at their screens the way John and Tom do on this 10-year yield?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, you know, first of all, if you take a look, I made this comment, I guess probably about 8 weeks ago, when we were about 150, which means that we were an equal chance that we would get 150 on the 10-year, equal chance we would get to 1% or 2%. And I was really vocal that if you end the year closer to one, the market is going to be weaker than if you end the year closer to two. The market likes higher rates, and people just don't want to buy into that idea. Higher rates are an indication that demand for capital is rising. It's a sign that the economy is strong. The reason the market is selling off today is because people are asking the question, what the heck is wrong that interest rates are falling when this economy is supposed to be so good? So, you know, we want higher interest rates. I would argue that if the interest rates continue to move towards one, that my optimism, I still think the market will be higher, that I'll be proven to be too optimistic. If interest rates back up towards 1.5, 1.75, the market is on fire.
To be clear here, John, we get a move down to one, and that 4,600 price target of yours is in question.
I think that the likelihood of me hitting that number is lower. And on the other hand, if we get towards 1.75 or 2%, I may be too light on my number. You are right. There's no question. The sentiment of the market right now is all tied to what's been going on with the 10-year. And if last earnings season is similar to this one, the market's going to care. If interest rates continue to fall apart, the market there's a chance it just ignores the earnings. I don't think that'll be the case, though.
Jonathan Gallup, Credit Suisse, Chief Equity Strategist. John,
did he give us a 5,000 target?
I think he didn't, Tom. He didn't. He said that if yields were higher, he might reevaluate higher.
Might
he said if yields came lower, he
we
might reevaluate.
Come on,
or there is
go
less
with
chance
that.
Of hitting that 4,600. I think you're being a little bit kind, Tom, about whether there was a move there.
We're thrilled that Rob Cornell would join us this morning. John, with your expertise on the ECB, why don't you bring in Mr. Cornell?
Hey, Rob, let's start with that. The price mandate over at the ECB, you know what it used to be, still is, in fact. It is below but close to 2%. That's set to change today, reportedly, to 2% with a tolerance for an overshoot. Does that change anything whatsoever for this central bank in Frankfurt, Rob?
But what it does is get rid of something that I think most of us have hated for years. I mean, we never really knew what it meant. Below but close to, was that 1.9? Was it 1.8? Was 1.7 close enough? So for starters, it gets rid of that horrible, you know, lack of certainty over what the actual mandate was. But you replace something which was close to 2 but below with effectively 2, and you can perhaps go over for a bit. And really what we're doing is we're doing what the Bank of Japan did many years ago when it moved from 1 to 2. You take a target, you shift it, you've got no more tools, you're going to miss it by a bigger margin. So it's all about credibility, and I don't necessarily think this is going to change an awful lot.
Well, Rob, their own forecast captured the credibility issue over at the ECB. On CPI, 1.9 for this year, 1.5 for next, 1.4 for the year after. Even with any interpretation of their mandate, even with that, even if it adapts, even if it changes in 25 minutes' time, whatever it is, Rob, they're still forecasting deceleration through CPI out to 1.4 and well below this target. So is their policy stance wrong, or do they just have zero credibility now to achieve it?
Well, I think you have to wonder whether these targets are actually sensible. Why two? Why not 1.5? Why have we chosen two? We don't seem to be able to achieve it. This year, of course, we have all the benefits of looking back at last year's terrible price level and a nice comparison. It just lifts everything. It makes it so much easier. But that won't last. We all know that. We've got a little bit of help from supply bottlenecks that's pushing things along as well a little bit. And we've had up until now a little bit of a push coming from OPEC Plus, at least giving us the sense that possibly they might do something with supply. But that's clearly not going to happen anymore. So oil's probably heading back down again. Credibility is a tough one. But, you know, why pin your colors to a particular number? It doesn't make sense.
Rob Carnell, frame for us the German response to what we're going to hear from Madame Lagarde today. The idea of moving from Otmar Issing onto Axel Weber and onto Weidmann, is this a different Germanic response, or is it going to be the same old, same old?
I think the German response has been mellowing over the years. I mean, they've been they've very, very much been Bundesbank over the years, which has been very anti a lot of the stuff that the ECB is doing, from quantitative easing to pretty much anything at the moment. But now that has changed. And Weidmann seems to be mellowing as well a little bit. I mean, he'll retain a sort of Germanic hawkishness throughout all of this, but I think they can see that there's some merits to pragmatism. Yeah. Within this, given that the previous policies just simply haven't worked.
You know, John Farrell gives us that often too, some Germanic hawkishness. We've noticed that as well. Rob, I'm going to steal from the good people over at Rabobank this morning. They make fun of the acronyms. It's like the military. Rabobank on the ECB, is it FIT? Is it FAT? Is it FLAT? Or is it FLOP? How big a flop is this going to be, old wise one?
Well, what they can always do is this, they can wrap this up in all sorts of other things as well. There's plenty of other stuff as well as the target that they'll be talking about. They'll be talking about whether or not they can bring in sort of more environmental targets. They can even talk about whether they should be thinking about a different type of inflation measure, perhaps bringing in house prices into this, which they haven't done particularly well. And talking about, do they need to think about headline rates as they've always done in the past? And we know that these are flipped around by all sorts of supply measures that they have absolutely no control over whatsoever. So, there are other things that they can do to try and minimize the focus on the fact that what they're really doing is tinkering around the edges of something which is fairly marginal.
Rob, what about the other components of this review, the employment component as well as this focus on climate change? How does that fold in to the inflation outlook as well?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question, this whole employment thing, because I think one of the things we noted pre-pandemic was that there was next to no relationship between the unemployment rate and what was happening to wages growth. Now, we are seeing something now. I mean, the US is giving us the rest of the world an interesting lesson in what's going on there, that there can actually be a relationship again. But we still don't know whether this is, for keeps, or whether this is simply a one-off price level adjustment as we adjust to the new norms of a post-pandemic world. So it's entirely possible that in 2 years' time, we still have a point where the economy is running okay, unemployment rate is rock bottom, and you still have no wages growth. Then what do you do? So I think, a complete change of viewing unemployment as a particularly causal factor could be helpful. But then what do you replace it with? There doesn't seem to be anything else to bring in to take its place.
When you look at sort of the lessons that we can learn from the shift that Japan made, and to a certain extent, the shift in tone that we saw out of the Fed here, how does the EU, and more importantly, how does the ECB, and more importantly, how does this sort of collection of countries, all that to a certain extent have different goals and to a certain extent different economies, how does the reaction, how does the outcome of this, if at all, end up different than what we're seeing in Japan and the US?
It might not. I think the one thing that we're doing at the moment is we just all focus a bit more on fiscal policy. I think if you accept that a lot of monetary policy around the world has run out of pep, that it's pushing on a string, it's been doing that for many years, then you have to look at something else. And fiscal policy, it's the story that we hear about from Washington in the US all the time. It's the story that we've begun to hear about finally from Europe as well. Japan's already run that race and spent everything. So I think that's where we head back to. That's what can push things along. But the money has to be spent sensibly. You can't just, print it and chuck it around in a sort of willy-nilly fashion. It has to be put to useful, productive uses.
Hey, Rob, it's been way too long. It's going to catch up. Rob Carnow there.
Likewise.
ING Asia-Pacific Head of Research and Chief Economist.
Katerina Simonetti is with us in Private the Wealth there. We rarely talk to people in the trenches, and we do so today. What's your biggest headache right now, Katerina, with people that say, I need to make money like it's in the market, but I don't want to take risk? What do you tell them?
Well, Tom, thank you for having me on the show. And it is such a weird environment that we're in, because on one side, our economic forecast remains to be positive. On the other side, for a while now, we have been calling for a correction, a pullback of some sort, you know, anywhere from potentially maybe 10 to 20, 15%. And we are saying this in the context of the bull market, but we're preparing our clients for the fact that this economic cycle seems to be happening a little bit too quickly, and some type of a pullback here just seems natural and normal. And this is not the reason to exit the market, but certainly a good trigger to reposition the portfolios, to go to safety, to take some profits off the table.
Katerina, your colleagues, particularly in the investment bank, the likes of Ellen Zettner, Chedanaya, I'm thinking of Andrew Sheets as well, I'm thinking of Mike Wilson, they've been focused on this cycle as well and where we are in this cycle. And a lot of people are struggling with that as a framework, because the team at Morgan Stanley believe we're already experiencing a mid to late cycle dynamic, a mid-cycle dynamic particularly. Katerina, explain that to our audience, why we're already there so quickly.
Well, generally, you know, these things take time, and bull markets last for a while. But because of so much stimulus and because of this whole, you know, economic reopening that we're going through, everything is happening quickly. And we seem to be going into this mid-cycle area of the market known for volatility, which is known for corrections and pullbacks. So because everything is happening quickly and economy is so stimulated, and there's some developments and concerns that we're having right now dealing with inflation, with labor shortages, with higher costs of materials. You know, on one side, we have this growth of recovery. On the other side, we have the volatility. So we think that the pullback and the correction at this stage in the recovery, in this mid-cycle transition that we, you know, believe that we find ourselves in, it's only natural here.
Only natural. And this is a pretty broad-based pullback, at least for today. I mean, pretty much nothing of significance higher here, at least in the pre-market. Katerina, I want to go back to the economic data that we've been getting, which has been mixed. And it's been mixed pretty much for the whole year, despite the fact that most people have taken much more of a glass half full approach to it. There were a lot of surprises out of that data, a lot of upside surprises, and that seemed to fuel a big part of this bull run that we had over the first few months of the year. Those surprises have sort of flattened out. And I'm wondering if you read into that any sense here that even if the economy continues to chug along and chug along higher, the idea here that we'll be pleasantly surprised in any meaningful way is past us.
Ramin, I think that one of the key factors here is that there seems to be a bit of a disconnect with the way Federal Reserve sees the inflation in the way that investors and consumers see the inflation in every single day of their life. And naturally, there are concerns. And so what we tell investors to do is to focus on earnings, to focus on quality, to focus on fundamentals, because I do believe that we are going to see the positive surprises. But we have to be very careful with our portfolio selection. We have to be very careful with our security selection. When we look at quality, we look at earnings, we look at the long-term opportunity, you know, for the stocks, to make sure that the valuations that we're seeing are actually supported by earnings, because we saw so much run up in some of the sectors of this economy, in some of the individual equity, that the question is this sustainable? So if there is ever a time to go to quality, to increase the overall quality of investment portfolios, this is the time.
Katerina, we've got to leave it there. It's always good to catch up. Thanks for joining us. Katerina Simonetti there, Morgan Stanley Private Wealth Management Senior Vice President.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Thanks for listening. Join us live weekdays from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio and on Bloomberg Television each day from 6 to 9 a.m. for insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. And subscribe to the Surveillance Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Terminal. I'm Tom Keene, and this is Bloomberg.